In this way, you see, we take away the meaning of the tragedy and we make the Palestinians into mindlessly violent people. They've become generically violent. Why would anyone throw a stone over a land dispute and a fence in a neighborhood? In this way, we also are having a lethal effect with our journalism. I would not be doing my job today if I didn't bring up the issue of journalism in Canada over the last 3 or 4 days. The dubious privilege of reading your newspapers has not been a happy one. You have your own examples, right there on page one, day after day, of what I call craven and potentially racist coverage of the arrest of 17 Muslims in Ontario for alleged terrorist offences. The most extraordinary thing I noticed was when your Prime Minister announced that that Islamic terrorists were against our Canadian values. Now, I'll tell you why I found this amazing, because after the July 7th bombings in London, I was two trains in front of one of those bombs, by the way, Tony Blair said exactly the same thing. These people were against our British values. And someone said, hold on a minute, it must be about Iraq. And indeed, the security services in Britain published a report specifically stating that they believed there was a connection. And Blair still denies this. Now, we do not know if the 17 men are guilty of any crime at all. Until their conviction or their release from jail, we will not know. But I can tell you one thing, that the anger of Muslims that I have spoken to in this country is very much about Canada's involvement in Afghanistan. Here is this morning's Globe and Mail, which I'm sure you've all bought and read. How many people in here, by the way, are buying Canadian newspapers with which they profoundly disagree? Hands up. There's a major problem you need to think about. Here's a good quote from today's editorial, the Globe and Mail. Canada is not in Afghanistan to oppress Muslims. Afghanistan under the Taliban was the most repressive and backward land on earth. Notice the logic here. We keep saying, we're in Iraq, we're not as bad as Saddam. He was really evil. You see, there's a problem. If the yardstick is going to be the Taliban for our behavior in Afghanistan or Saddam for our behavior in Iraq, that gives us quite a lot of leeway, doesn't it? Haditha, Abu Ghraib, Bagram prison in Afghanistan. I go on with this wonderful editorial. Canada is there to help that nation rebuild and to prevent it from becoming a leading base for international terrorism again. I thought we'd solve that problem. The real reason that the Canadians' team in Kandahar are on active military operations is to relieve the American forces there so they can go and fight more Muslim insurgents in Iraq. Again, none of this justifies violence of any kind. And I repeat, I am against violence of any kind ever against anyone. But there are realities we must deal with. One of those realities is an extraordinary racism that I'm picking up in your newspaper columns. Listen to this. This is this morning's Globe and Mail. Remember the picture. I want you to see what you might think is wrong, and I'm putting the word wrong rather meekly here, with this particular quotation. This is a description by a man who allegedly saw the alleged, quote, terrorists, unquote, being arrested by the RCMP. Parked directly outside his Magic Motorcycles office was a large grey cube-shaped truck. And on the ground nearby, he recognized one of the two brown-skinned young men. There's a problem there, isn't there? Does that give us the race, the religion, or the original nationality? And, you know, would we call them yellow-skinned young men if there was a different religion involved? Where is this taking us? I mean, I tell you frankly, if we use the phrase brown-skinned young men in a British press, we'd be taken to the press council for it. And you see, there's another element here which is very important, and that is that a new phraseology has been introduced, like, you know, colonies become settlements, become neighborhoods, and walls become fences, and occupiers become disputes. You have another one, and that is homegrown. I love this phrase, like, you know, the weed, the plant goes up like this. And much more seriously, we've got Canadian-born Muslims. What does that mean? It means that Canadians are now being divided into two classes. Those who were born in Canada, and who obviously were Canadian citizens, and Canadian citizens, the rest, the other, you see. So always the phrase now used about Muslims, I notice in your press, is Canadian-born. I mean, forgive me for saying so, but if I was called British-born Robert Fisk, I think it was a bit odd. I mean, I'm a Brit, of course I am. We're all trying to avoid in these newspapers the fact that all the people we're talking about are Canadians, like I would be if I was born here, and would want to be if I was born here. Of course, we notice all the way through your press, I love the piece from Margaret, is it Went, she pronounces her name? No. Wente? Well, I know, no, wait, you need to hear this. But this is a lady who concludes her article, Canada is not exempt from homegrown terrorism. Angry young men are the tinderbox and Islamism is the match. But then we have, before I go on, one disclaimer, nothing has been proven and nobody should rush to judgment. What are you doing, your newspaper people? I mean, you know, and again, you know, the British security services, who admitted in a report that Blair tried to keep secret but failed to do so, that there was a clear connection between Iraq and the July 7 bombings. We have Jack Hooper, your famous CSIS chief, who doesn't always learn a lot but certainly talks a lot, saying, quote, we had a high threat profile before Afghanistan. He means Canada's involvement in active operations. In any event, the presence of Canadians and Canadian forces there has elevated that threat somewhat. You know, forgive me, I don't find it very funny at all, because we've been through this one in London and we ended up with tube trains blowing up. I don't know, I hope never anything like this happens in Canada. But I think that Canadians should be aware of the political and military implications of what the Canadian military are doing in Afghanistan. This is in no way trying to besmirch the image of the individual soldiers who are there. I've met some. I've met Canadians in Bosnia. In fact, it was a young Canadian officer in Bosnia who was sheltering in a ditch with me one day when we were under Serb gunfire. And I said, you're a UN soldier. Can't you do anything about this? And he said, Robert, he said, if the UN had existed before the First World War, the Battle of the Somme might never have taken place. This is nothing to what could happen if we weren't around. And you know, I think he was right. I'm a believer in the UN. I was very struck at the UN General Assembly on September the 12th, 2002, when George Bush made his famous remark that the UN was in danger of being turned into a League of Nations. Apparently ignorant that the League of Nations failed because the United States wouldn't join it and the major superpowers of the time walked out and didn't obey its rulings. So, here we have Jonathan Kay in the National Post this morning. The spectre of, here we go again, homegrown Canadian Muslims. You grow them at home or they're homegrown? Plotting to attack targets inside their own country. There isn't even a disclaimer that no one's actually been proved guilty of this. I'm not saying that no one will be. All I'm saying is there's something wrong, something terribly, terribly wrong at the moment with your reporting of events in Canada, and it's worse even than ours. Not perhaps as bad as the United States. So we ask the question why. Actually, we're trying in this country not to ask the question why. Of course, we can't ask the question why because nothing has been proven, but we know some Muslims are angry. Don't talk about Afghanistan, just as we couldn't talk about the Middle East after September the 11th, just as we were not supposed to talk about Iraq after July the 7th in Britain. The amazing thing, if you actually research back through all this history, go back 50, 60, 70 years, and we were behaving just the same. Right back to Pope Urban, we were making these comments about the Muslim world. At the period of Andalusia, when in the 15th century the Christian forces drove out the Muslims and the Jews from Spain, extraordinary cartoons were appearing in the presses of Spain and Europe. I've seen some of them shown to me by the professor of Hispanic Studies at Trinity College Dublin, my old university, which depict the Prophet Muhammad having sex. Not unlike the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad with a bomb in his turban. I was in New Zealand the other day giving an address to the Dominion Herald, a wonderful newspaper, the Dominion Herald. Are you still a Dominion, by the way? No, I'm glad for you. Anyway, the Dominion Herald, and they said, you know, the editor was saying, what do you think of us? They published the cartoons too. What do you think of this? Isn't it freedom of the press? And I said, look, I've got a question to ask you. Would you publish a cartoon of a rabbi with a bomb in his hat? And he said, no. And I said, you're absolutely right not to, because you'd be accused of anti-Semitism, and you would be right to be accused of anti-Semitism. But you publish a picture of the Prophet with a bomb in his turban. It's amazing, isn't it, the double standards that get built in over the years. Let me do to a different kind of historical parallel. You know, we're always going to the Middle East, rescuing the Middle Eastern people. Christians, Jews, Muslims, were always going there wanting to give them freedom. When Napoleon went to Egypt during the Egyptian expedition of the 18th century, He published a proclamation saying he wanted to give freedom to the people of Cairo who were being hanged by the pashas for exercising free speech. In 1917, the British army invaded Iraq. They were told by British intelligence in Basra that they'd be greeted with flowers and water, sweet water. When the British conquered Iraq, General Sir Angus Maud, British commanding officer in Baghdad, soon to die of cholera because he didn't boil his milk, published a proclamation. On the walls it went up around Baghdad, and a young private, Charles Dickens, of the Cheshire Regiment, a regiment my father was in before he was in France in the King's Liverpool Regiment, tore down one of these posters from the wall, thinking that one day it might be historic. And he put it in his backpack, where it remained for a year, being stained yellow by his own perspiration in the hot summer in Iraq of 1918. And eventually he passed it on to his daughter, who sold it to me for $2,000 just before I finished my book, and I hung it on beside my desk. And it begins, 1917, to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad. We come here not as conquerors, but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny. I kid thee not. Much better still as you go along. In 1920, an insurgency began against British troops in Iraq. It began with the execution of a British Captain Townsend at a place called Handari, which is near Abu Ghraib, which would be much more famous for your name. And I know Handari very well because in the summer of 2003, I went there to investigate the first killing of an American soldier by a roadside bomb. And when I was in Handari, a man came up to me and he said, "Inglesey?" "Yes." He said, "My grandfather killed Captain Townsend over there." Talk about a repeat of history. What did the British do after Captain Townsend's death in 1920? They shelled a city called Fallujah in retaliation. They also surrounded a city called Najaf, and they demanded the handing over of a Shiite prelate called Badr, not Sadr, Badr. We got Badr. The Americans did not get Sadr. British intelligence in Baghdad then sent a telegram, which I've seen, to the War Department in London, Ministry of Defence, in 1920, saying, perhaps you can help me out here, you'll know the answer to this, that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from... Yes, you see, you knew what British intelligence said in 1920, didn't you? Lloyd George then stood up. The occupation was becoming extremely unpopular in Britain. It was costing a lot of money. The Iraqis didn't seem to benefit the fruits we were going to give them. Elections would come later. And Lloyd George stood up in the House of Commons in, this is 1920, it's in the Times of the time, Times parliamentary column. He stood up in the House of Commons and Lloyd George said, "If British troops leave Iraq now, there will be..." Yep. You see, you've been reading the Times report on Lloyd George, haven't you? Only we didn't read that before we invaded Iraq. It's amazing, this fingerprint quality which infects the repetition of history in the Middle East. We're always going to the Middle East to offer freedom, wealth, new lives to the Muslim Arabs. I think Arabs and Muslims in general would like some of that democracy. I think they'd like a few packets of human rights from our Western supermarket shelves. But I think they want another kind of freedom. They would like freedom from us. And this, I think... And this, I think, we do not intend to give them. We go there with our Apache helicopters and our swords and our horses and our Abrams tanks and our Bradley fighting armored vehicles, and we're always amazed that they don't really want us there. Yes, Saddam was terrible, but is he the yardstick? I think he probably is, unfortunately for all of us. I have an equation I always use about the Americans now in Iraq, that they must leave and they will leave, and they can't leave. And that is the equation that turns sand into blood. You know, I go back over the files of my own colleagues, of other writers, historians. I go back and try to find out what they were saying before Palestine was destroyed, before the Israeli state was created. And the creation of the Israeli state was a matter for Israelis of great heroism and great creative moment after the Holocaust in Europe. We know that. George Antonius, Christian Arab historian, wanted an independent Arab state in which as many Jews as the country could hold without prejudice to its political and economic freedom would live in peace, security, and dignity, and have full rights of citizenship. Fearing what he called an unpredictable holocaust of Arab, Jewish, and British lives, those were his words, Help for the Jews of Europe, he said, must be sought elsewhere than in Palestine. I'm going to quote to you George Antonius in 1938. The treatment meted out to Jews in Germany and other European countries is a disgrace to its authors and to modern civilization. But posterity will not exonerate any country that fails to bear its proper share of the sacrifices needed to alleviate Jewish suffering and distress. To place the brunt of the burden upon Arab Palestine is a miserable evasion of the duty that lies upon the whole of the civilized world. It is also morally outrageous. No code of morals can justify the persecution of one people in an attempt to relieve the persecution of another. The cure for the eviction of Jews from Germany is not to be sought in the eviction of the Arabs from their homeland, and the relief of Jewish distress may not be accomplished at the cost of inflicting distress upon an innocent and peaceful population. 1938. It's astonishing to read this, but here is another man, much better known, called Winston Churchill, writing a year earlier, in 1937, about what might happen in Palestine. Remember, this is 2 years before the Second World War. Churchill wrote of the impossibility of a partition Palestine. And here is his prophecy. The wealthy, crowded, progressive Jewish state lies in the plains and on the seacoasts of Palestine. Around it, in the hills and the uplands, stretching far and wide into the illimitable deserts, the warlike Arabs of Syria, of Transjordania, of Arabia, backed by the armed forces of Iraq, offer the ceaseless menace of war. To maintain itself, the Jewish state must be armed to the teeth and must bring in every able-bodied man to strengthen its army. This is still Churchill I'm quoting. But how long would this process be allowed to continue by the great Arab populations in Iraq and Palestine? Can it be expected that the Arabs would stand by impassively and watch the building up with Jewish world capital and resources of a Jewish army equipped with the most deadly weapons of war until it was strong enough not to be afraid of them? And if ever the Jewish army reached that point, who can be sure that, cramped within their narrow limits, they would not plunge out into the new undeveloped lands that lie around them? Winston Churchill, 1937. Writing about the dispossession of the Palestinians in 48 is one of the most depressing experiences in journalism. However much we tried to write about that dispossession and the killings and murders and suffering and tragedy that followed, we journalists would be abused constantly and always with the use of the same word that was used against all the West's enemies, terror. Terrorism is a word that had become a plague on our vocabulary. The excuse and reason and moral permit for state-sponsored violence, our violence, which is now used on the innocent of the Middle East ever more outrageously and promiscuously. Terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. It's become a full stop, a punctuation mark, a phrase, a speech, a sermon, the be-all and end-all of everything we must hate in order to ignore injustice and occupation and killing on a large scale. Terror, 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 terror. It is a sonata, a symphony, an orchestra tuned to every television and radio station. Do you remember George Bush said the war on terror might go on forever? Eternal war we were being offered after 2001. Rarely in history have soldiers and journalists and presidents and kings aligned themselves in such thoughtless and questioning ranks. In August of 1914, for example, the soldiers of Britain, France, and Germany all thought they'd be home by Christmas. The war is to be eternal. The enemy is eternal. But his face changes on our screens. Once he lived in Cairo and was a rather plump man. He nationalized the Suez Canal. So we bombed him. Anthony Eden called him the Mussolini of the Nile. Then later on, another man in a crazy military uniform popped up in Tripoli and helped the IRA, and he got bombed too. Later on, another hate figure popped up. This was a man who ate yogurt in a house in Tehran and wanted to spread Islamic revolution. Then again, of course, we had that man in the cave with the long white beard who issued these rather worrying videotapes. And after that, of course, we came to the man with a moustache but no beard who lived in a palace in Baghdad. The French have a good word for this kind of thing, infantilisme, which I think translates best as babyishness. This is what you are fed, ladies and gentlemen, in your newspapers, on your television, by your prime ministers, your presidents. This is what it's about. I gave a lecture some time ago in New York, in Manhattan again, and I asked the audience, because I didn't know the answer, could anyone tell me when the vision of bin Laden, following September 11, 2001, faded from the screen to be replaced by Saddam. At some point, it switched round. And, of course, the journalists didn't notice this or didn't choose to point it out to us because they were doing the switching. And about a month later, I got in Beirut a letter from a professor, American professor, who was present in my lecture. And he said, well, I've just found out the answer, Mr. Fisk. Like all professors, he sent me reams and reams of computerized garbage I couldn't possibly understand. He's an anthropologist, actually, that explains it. And what he did find is that the number of mentions of bin Laden at about 360 a week suddenly went down to almost zero, and Saddam went up to about 360 a week, exactly coinciding with the moment of the Enron scandal. Now, isn't that extraordinary? I wonder why. But the fact is that the transition was accomplished seamlessly with our help. Now, I wonder sometimes why we do this. We journalists, we have this osmotic, parasitic relationship with power. We like to be close to governments. The most perfect example of this I'll give you, I see this all the time, but this was a classic example. I was in Los Angeles promoting this tombstone of a book of mine, and I opened my Los Angeles Times. The time was, what, November 16. Front page story. In a battle of wits, Iraq's insurgency mastermind. We love masterminds in journalism. That's why we call scientists boffins. In a battle of wits, Iraq's insurgency mastermind stays a step ahead of the United States. The story is written by two journalists in Washington, very good place to write about Iraq, and it begins, despite the recent arrest of one of his would-be suicide bombers in Jordan and some top aides in Iraq, insurgency mastermind Abu Musab Zarqawi has eluded capture, U.S. authorities say, because his network has a much better intelligence gathering operation. But listen to the sourcing of this exclusive story. We've got U.S. officials say. Column 1, page 1, U.S. officials said. Said one U.S. Justice Department counterterrorism official. Column 2, officials said, U.S. authorities say, U.S. officials said. It gets better on page 10, I beg you not to laugh. Page 10, column 1, several U.S. officials said, those officials said, the U.S. officials confirmed, American officials complained. They said, U.S. officials stressed, U.S. authorities believe, we're in column 3 now, said one senior U.S. intelligence official, U.S. officials said, Jordanian officials said, slight change there to keep us interested. Several U.S. we've got to column 4. I don't know if I'm going to finish this today. Several U.S. officials said, the U.S. officials said, column 5. American officials said, column 6. Officials say U.S. officials, U.S. officials said one U.S. counterterrorism official. Ladies and gentlemen, sometimes I think that the L.A. Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post should just be called U.S. officials say.